This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
We're going to now talk about this issue of overtesting as people age and get older. So my perspective on this is very influenced by my specialty of geriatrics. So geriatrics is a specialty of medicine that cares for older people and thinks about how to improve the quality of life and well-being of older people. So I'm sometimes asked, when do you need a geriatrician, at what age? And it's a hard question to answer, actually, because it's really when you develop the impairments and the disabilities and the problems that go along with old age. So in some people, that happens really early, in their 50s and 60s. But a lot of people are fortunate not to have those problems into their 80s or 90s. So it really depends. But in geriatrics, we are really concerned about how to best take care and improve the quality of life of people who develop these problems. So this picture is Robert Butler. So Bob Butler is a hero to a lot of us in the field of aging and geriatrics. Probably more than anyone in the U.S. was responsible for the development of geriatrics. So in the 1960s, he wrote this landmark book called Ageism, where he coined the term and, you know, talked about discrimination of people based on age as bad and serious as racism and sexism, and really lamented the stereotyping of older people. And this has had a big influence on my field of geriatrics and on how we think about care of older people. But something interesting has happened in the 50 years since Bob Butler described this phenomenon. So kind of what hasn't happened is, in some ways, geriatricians are refugees from the rest of medicine. A lot of people go into geriatrics because we kind of don't like the way the rest of medicine is practiced. So geriatricians have long seen themselves, in part, not on whole, but in part, as protecting older persons from a health system that does not address the needs of older persons. So in the early years of this specialty, in the 1960s, a lot of geriatricians were concerned about the issue of undertreatment, that somebody who's old will go to their doctor with a problem and they'll be blown off just because they're old, and they'll just assume their problem is due to aging and do nothing about the problem. And in fact, there is some role for that still in geriatrics, so that, you know, I sometimes have the experience taking care of older patients where it's my role to say, you know what, you're 85 and you are not too old for a hip or knee replacement if you're having a lot of pain. In the right patient, even really invasive things like coronary artery bypass grafting can be still appropriate in people in their late 80s. But something has happened, though. Now, much more than worrying about undertreatment, geriatricians talk about the problem of overtreatment. And when I talk to my colleagues about our war stories and what we've done, or when we've consulted on a patient, what changes we've made, it's pretty rare that we talk about doing a new treatment. We're much more likely to talk about the drug we stopped, the treatment that we decided not to give, the diagnostic test that we decided was not indicated, or the procedure that we stopped. So that when we think about what we do to help our older patients, it's more often doing less medical care and not so often doing more. So what crazy things have happened in the United States in the last 50 years? And so it's really care consistent with the goals of each individual. And the word here is individual. So the key to good aging care is actually not pigeonholing patients, but really thinking about the person in front of you. So it's the Goldilocks phenomenon. Not too much, not too little, but just right care. Care that's consistent with the goals of the individual, which often can be longer life, and yes, even when you're in your 80s or 90s, you still often want to live as long as possible, but it's often better function, better physical function, cognitive function, doing things that are socially important to you. A lot of overtreatment stems from the failure to see the patient as a unique individual. It often comes from treating the numbers, but not actually treating a symptom or a problem that's ailing the patient in front of us. So what this graph describes is there's two basic phenomena. So on the bottom of the graph, you have the names of countries. These are, by and large, most of the developed countries in the world, with a few exceptions here made to make some interesting contrasts. So that purple line is how much you will get spent on you on average in this in the country of interest on your health. So you kind of see that jagged line, and then you see this humongous spike that's off the charts. So in the United States, you'll get more spent on you for healthcare than anywhere else in the world. So maybe one thing you do get in the U.S. that's, you know, exceptional is you have the chance for an exceptional amount of healthcare treatments and diagnostic tests. So what do you get for that? Well, those blue bars are average life expectancy in each of these countries. So, you know, a cynical way to look at this is if you want to live longer, maybe you shouldn't be born in the United States. Because, you know, so you look at Japan, you'll live a really long time in Japan, on average over 81 years. And then the United States is way on the bottom. On this graph, they're fifth from the bottom, with average life expectancy about 78 years. So for all this extra health care we're getting in the U.S., we are not living longer. The country we beat, the United States barely beats Cuba in terms of life expectancy. So somehow all this stuff we get does not help us. So what are some of the solutions? So I think we are good people in medicine. We don't aim to do badly. And the statement, patients first, disease second, sounds good. And, you know, most of us would argue we do this. But there's very serious cultural forces that might conspire against this. So part of this is the way we are taught. So when we go to medical school, we learn about medicine one disease at a time. So we'll learn about diabetes and heart disease and lung disease. So we tend to sort of put diseases into boxes that are divorced from the patients. Then when we get into practice, we often are forced with these practice guidelines. So when you're seeing patients in a health system like the VA or Kaiser, there are these very well-intended guidelines that tell us what to do for each disease. Not for each patient, for each disease. So it'll tell you what to do for diabetes and what tests to order and what treatments to give, what tests to do for lung disease. This makes sense if you have one disease, but the problem is that most of us have more than one disease. I shouldn't say most of us, but most people as they get older have more than one disease. As you age, you accumulate diseases, and this becomes a big mess when you have lots of problems. This slide has a lot of stuff on it, and you might think there's too many things on it that makes it so it makes the slide unreadable. And that is the whole point. So this was a landmark analysis done by a colleague of mine at Hopkins, Cynthia Boyd. And she asked the question, like, let's take a 79-year-old woman with five diseases. And this is not at all atypical. Lots of 79-year-olds have five diseases. So this is high blood pressure, diabetes, osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, and COPD, which some people call emphysema. And she said, okay, if we give the right care, if we give the guideline-recommended care for each of these diseases, what is this patient's life going to be like? So on the left-hand column are all the so-called appropriate medicines that this patient has to be on through the course of the day to meet the guidelines for all five diseases. And on the other side of this are all the things he has to do during the day in terms of behavioral management and non-medicine management for her disease. So now the point of this is what the guidelines really recommend. And if you're at Kaiser or the VA, if you're the doctor, you will get a good grade for doing all of this stuff. So this turns out to be classified as excellent care for each of these conditions, but it's horrible care for the patient. So maybe excellent medical care, so-called, but this is a pretty terrible life. So there's something we're doing wrong in terms of how we think about actual patients and not just the diseases they have. So I'm going to illustrate this problem further by talking briefly about two very common diseases in older people. For the first example I'm going to give you is overtreatment of diabetes. So diabetes is a condition on which, you know, if you're in any health system that grades the quality of care, it's going to be intensively measured. And a lot of doctors are graded by how well they will control blood sugar in somebody with diabetes. And the goal of a lot of diabetes care is to so-called normalize the blood sugar. Now, that seems to make sense if you sort of think about it loosely. Diabetes is a disease of high blood sugar. Treatment should bring it back to normal. Well, it's actually not true. And we've learned that if we try too hard to normalize blood sugar, we actually make life shorter in people with type 2 diabetes. So I'll briefly contrast type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So type 1 diabetes is the diabetes that happens in children usually, and it's a disease where you completely stop making insulin. And in type 1 diabetes, it's true that you probably should try to normalize the blood glucose level, blood sugar level, as close to normal. Type 2 diabetes, in fact, most older people who have type 2 diabetes are making too much insulin. It's a disease where the body becomes resistant to insulin. Completely different diseases in a lot of ways, but they ended up getting treated the same way to the detriment of patients. It turns out that older patients, even though they're treated as if they just have diabetes, they have lots of other problems than diabetes. And the outcome of the way we treat them has been an epidemic of geriatric hypoglycemia. So this is a study that was published in JAMA Internal Medicine, and I slightly modified the title based on an editorial Dr. Redberg wrote about this paper. So this is a paper that looked at what has changed in terms of how we hospitalize people for diabetes over the past 20 years or so. So if you're going to hospitalize a patient with diabetes, your first thought would be, okay, diabetes. If you're going to hospitalize them for their blood sugar, it'll be because their blood sugar has gone too high. That's what the disease does. But you could also be hospitalized because the blood sugar goes too low. So if it goes really low, you could cause cognitive problems. You could cause somebody to lose consciousness. So you could also be hospitalized for what we do to the patient. The only way, essentially, to get blood sugar too low in diabetes is with the medicines we use. So in 1999, if you took 100 hospitalizations for blood sugar and diabetes, just 100 random hospitalizations, 55 of them would be for high blood sugar, a problem caused by the disease, and 45 would be for low blood sugar, a problem we cause by our treatments. So what's happened with medical progress up to 2011? So in 2011, of those 100 hospitalizations, 40 will be for high blood sugar caused by the disease, 60 will be for hypoglycemia, problems caused by our treatments. So there are now more hospitalizations for diabetes that are due to iatrogenesis. So iatrogenesis is a problem caused by our medical treatments, not by the disease itself, than by the disease. So as Dr. Redberg noted in her editorial, this seems to be a watershed moment for how we care for older people. And these patients were all seniors. That we now hospitalize more patients for diabetes for what we do to them than for the disease itself. One concern we have in geriatrics is diabetes management for very vulnerable seniors. So as a geriatrician, I care for a lot of patients who have walking difficulty, who have cognitive impairment, who have a lot of the problems of old age. So this has been a real problem for how we care for older people, because for many years, the guidelines for caring for diabetes didn't care that your patient had a lot of other problems and had all the problems of old age. And it turns out overly aggressive blood sugar control is particularly hazardous in seniors with impaired physical or cognitive function. So this was a study done in 367 very disabled older persons, and it was done by my colleagues at UCSF in the Division of Geriatrics. So what they did was they looked at these 367 patients with diabetes, and they said, who was at the highest and who was at the lowest risk of further progression of their disability over the course of several years? So diabetes's control is measured with something called the glycohemoglobin, or hemoglobin A1C. So if you don't have diabetes, it'll be below 6. The guidelines suggest that we keep it below 7. If it goes above 8, in a lot of health systems, you'll be flagged as having bad care. So it turned out in these patients, the lowest risk of worsening disability were in patients whose glycohemoglobin was 8.5, way above the recommendations, but, you know, reasonable control for patients who are this sick. Most of these guidelines would have pushed their blood sugar far lower and called these patients as having received not so good care, even though it turned out their care was very good. So I'm going to give a second example of overtreatment. I'm going to talk briefly about dementia. Dementia costs a lot of money. There's large costs for medical treatments, often for treatments that are harmful. However, Medicare doesn't pay for treatments that cost a lot less, in part because they're called social care, not medical care. But the kinds of care that improve quality of life are less expensive and unavailable. So one area where there's a big problem with overtreatment is when a patient with dementia goes to the hospital. So this happens a lot. But when a patient with dementia goes to the hospital, it's usually not because of dementia. It's because patients with dementia often have 5 other diseases. And it turns out to be one of those other 5 other diseases that sends them to the hospital. But it's like when they go to the hospital, they end up on this glide path where it's completely ignored that they have dementia. So hospitals turn out to be particularly dangerous for people who have physical and cognitive problems, and it often exacerbates those problems. Unfortunately, patients with physical and cognitive problems who go to the hospital end up getting treated just the same as younger, healthier patients, often with bad consequences. So here's a study that was published by Sean Morrison, a geriatrician in New York, in 2000. And if anything, I would guess this problem is worse than when he published his study. So he looked at 118 patients with advanced dementia. So this is patients not just with dementia, but dementia that's really progressed to the point where patients have become bedbound. And asked, well, what kinds of things do we do to these patients in the hospital? So half of these patients had pneumonia, half of them had hip fracture. So the kinds of things we do with them, 58% had a catheter inserted in her bladder, which causes infection and is uncomfortable. And if you are not walking before you have that catheter, you won't be walking afterwards. 45% had blood draws every day. 55% had an IV catheter for their whole hospital stay. But what did we not do? Only 7% had evidence that there was a discussion with their family about the risks and benefits of burdensome interventions. And remember, half of these patients had hip fracture, but only 24% were treated for pain. Here's another problem that, so the word feeding tube kind of will set a geriatrician into a rage, in part because it's really become the symbol for everything that's bad about what we do to patients with dementia. So when patients with dementia reach an advanced stage, it often is associated with weight loss and decreased eating. And unfortunately, treatment with feeding tubes, basically tubes that you put into the stomach to artificially provide nutrition, are often the treatments. But now there's pretty good evidence they don't improve survival. So you might say, well, that's strange. If you're not eating, shouldn't something that provides nourishment improve survival? Well, it turns out it's not. The reason patients with dementia who are losing weight have decreased survival is actually not because they're not eating. It's because they have advanced dementia. The lack of eating is just part of that syndrome. The feeding tubes, though, are very uncomfortable. They have numerous complications. It turns out we've learned that actually if you really judiciously hand-feed a patient with dementia, they will do just as well as having a tube feed in terms of nutrition. The problem is it takes a lot of work to do this. So if you're in a nursing home, it actually will be a lot less work on a nursing home to put in a feeding tube than to do hand feeding, which might actually take several hours a day. The other double whammy here is that nursing home will get paid more for putting in the feeding tube because the patient gets classified as a sicker patient. So they get rewarded for doing bad care. So the feeding tube really symbolizes all that's wrong. It's a failure to seriously engage and communicate with families, and it's really a failure to really address patients' palliative needs. So what do patients with dementia really need? So to take a step back here, as a geriatrician or somebody who takes care of older people, maybe it's the best and worst of times. So if spending unlimited dollars is the best of times, maybe it is the best of times. Because as a geriatrician, I have unlimited capacity to spend money on patients and to spend Medicare's money. I can order unlimited tests. I can throw brain scans at patients. I can do procedures. I can send them to the hospital. I can spend lots of money on all the stuff that will hurt my patients and that they don't need, but I actually can't spend less money on the stuff that would really help them. So the kinds of things that patients with dementia really need are things that improve patient and social engagement, things like a day health center that engages them, things that promote social engagement. Patients with dementia can't drive anymore, usually, and it would be nice to be able to provide them with transportation so they could still do the things that are meaningful to them. It would be nice to promote physical activity, which even in dementia improves well-being, and help them with their basic activities of daily living. It would also be really nice to help the caregiver, to provide them training, to give them respite, to provide them psychosocial support, and promote employment policies that allow a caregiver to take time off from work. So none of this stuff is covered. It would cost less than the stuff we actually can pay for, but right now we can't get this for patients. So Dr. Redberg talked about the Choosing Wisely campaign. So, and she mentioned every medical society was asked to submit 5 recommendations. The geriatricians went crazy. We just couldn't stop submitting recommendations. So the geriatricians so far have submitted 15 things. Right here it says 10, but we're now up to 15. Things that we think people should stop doing to older people that cause more harm than benefit, and we'll probably go up to 20 and 25. But 2 of them are things I mentioned. One of them is avoiding over excess control of blood sugar and diabetes, and another is avoiding tube feedings in patients with dementia. So why has it happened that there are so many geriatric items on the Choosing Wisely list? Part of it is because some of the issues we've talked about. It's the ignoring of the problem that older people come with multiple diseases. Some of it's very well-meaning. It's this well-meaning attempt that when you have a patient with a problem to so-called do something, even when that something does not work or is harmful. So I had a chief resident who tried to turn around that statement that we've all heard, don't just stand there, do something, to, you know, just don't do something, stand there and think for a second. And we need to do a little bit more of that advice. It's also not recognizing when the goals of care have shifted to palliation. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So palliation is care that's focused not on modifying the course of a disease, but treating its impact on patients and treating the symptoms of disease. So the impairments of old age, which include death, can often be delayed or slowed, but they can't be permanently prevented. As illness and disability increase, medical intervention becomes less and less effective, and the effectiveness of the things we do, you know, goes down and the harms go up. But there's always something we can do, and that something is often palliation, a focus on improving quality of life, not necessarily slowing illness, but making life better. And failing to recognize when this shift occurs often leads to harmful medical intervention and inadequate palliative treatments. So I'm going to close by just describing how some of my thinking about medicine has changed as I've been moved from like my traditional medical school training to really sort of thinking more as a geriatrician. So the story I'll tell is, you know, that so that as a clinician and a primary care provider, we try to do our best for our patients. But there are patients that sometimes, you know, we get a little bit of a headache because doing our best we know is going to be hard work. So when we see a patient that has a long list of diseases, it can seem overwhelming. You know, it's probably more overwhelming for the patient, but it's often overwhelming for the doctor who wants to do the right thing. So here's an example of a patient that, you know, I might be assigned to see who has, like, lots of diseases. And, like, if I know I'm about to see them, I'm going to be trying to get my head around, okay, how am I going to get control of all these problems? Earlier in my career, and this is the approach I was taught in medical school, my approach would have been to go through each of these diseases one by one. So when I saw the patient, I try to get the history of each disease, and I try to think about the medicines that are on for each disease, and I try to think about what tests I have to do for each disease and which treatment I have to do for each disease. What I've learned from my friends in geriatrics is not to do it the way I was taught in medical school. So now I don't even start by like asking my patients about their diseases. I really try to learn how they're doing. I ask them about their function. I ask them about how they're doing physically. You know, do you have trouble walking? Do you have trouble with your self-care activities like bathing and getting dressed? What activities are important to you? How's your caregiver doing? Do you have any cognitive problems? And I might do some testing for that. Have you fallen? And, you know, I might even, the first time I see them, not even ask them about their diseases. I'll just go through all the functional stuff. But then I can go back and rethink their diseases based on how they're functioning. And suddenly that list of diseases isn't so bewildering anymore that I realize, well, actually, maybe some of those diseases I can ignore because it's not really what's bothering my patient. And maybe there's other things I should emphasize more. And maybe some tests I am going to do might help me diagnose things but might make their function worse. So in fact, you know, this sounds like more work. I have to now talk about function, but it becomes a lot less work as a clinician, and it becomes better for my patients. So to sum up, more is not always better. Medical interventions and tests can be helpful or harmful. Advancing age, the accumulation of diseases, disability, and cognitive problems often increase the chance of harm. Careful assessment of each older person, and including personal goals, is essential to knowing just when to say no to too many tests and procedures. So, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.